Morning. In April, we looked at Solomon's Temple and some of the more prominent features of Solomon's Temple. We looked at the symbols that portrayed the way of life and things that were parabolic of future events. Today, our assigned objective is Herod's Temple. But before we look directly into that, I think it would be well if we traced a little bit of history that will lead us to that objective eventually, because there was another temple involved between Solomon's Temple and Herod's Temple, so we want to say some things about that as well. Solomon's Temple stood for about 362 years from the 11th year of Solomon's reign until its destruction in 586 B.C. And just prior to that last date, there was a significant event that's recorded in the book of Ezekiel, and that is the departing glory. And we want to look at that for just a minute, because it plays a part in some of the things that we want to say at the end of our remarks today. So we're going to go ahead and establish the fact now. Then we're going to come back and deal with that a little bit later, but we want to look directly at that for the time being. Now, the prophetic account of this particular event, that is the departing of the Shekinah glory from Solomon's Temple, is an event that's found in the 8th through the 11th chapters of the book of Ezekiel. And in that account, we see that because of the detestable, abominable, and idolatrous practices of Judah, the beauty of his ornament, that is Solomon's Temple, the beauty of his ornament, Solomon's Temple, was thereby polluted and would be further defiled and destroyed by the Babylonian scourge that would not only destroy Jerusalem, but her people as well. Okay, Ezekiel, the 10th chapter, we read, "Then I looked, and behold, in the firmament that was above the head of the cherubims, there appeared over them, as it were, a sapphire stone, and as the appearance of the likeness of a throne." And we'll get into this description in just a minute. But what's being portrayed here is that there were cherubim, the cherubic chariot, and it was carrying a throne, and above that was to be the Shekinah glory. So the Shekinah glory then is here depicted as riding upon a throne, which was being carried by the cherubic chariot. Okay, next verse. "Now the cherubim stood on the right side of the house when the man went in, and the cloud filled the inner court. Then the glory of the Lord went up from the cherub and stood over the threshold of the house, and the house was filled with the cloud, and the court was full of the brightness of the Lord's glory. Then the glory of the Lord departed from off the threshold of the house, and it stood over the cherubims. And the cherubims lifted up their wings, and they mounted up from the earth in my sight. When they went out, the wheels also were beside them, and every one stood at the door of the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of the Lord of Israel was over them. Then did the cherubims lift up their wings, and the wheels beside them, and the glory of God of Israel was over them above. And the glory of the Lord went up from the midst of the city, and stood upon the mountain which is on the east side of the city." And of course, that would be the Mount of Olives. Keep that in mind. This is a diagram of what it describes the verses that we just read. The Shekinah glory, as we know, dwelt upon the top of the mercy seat between the cherubim, and it left its place above the mercy seat. It went from there to the threshold, that is the porch of the temple. And then from the temple porch, it went to the throne upon the cherubic chariot that awaited for it on the right side of the temple. It left there, it went to the east gate, it left the east gate and went to the Mount of Olives, and from there it ascended eventually. So, this graphic then, we see that the Shekinah glory then moved from its place and it departed the temple. And from that time forward, the Shekinah glory no more dwelt in any temple of Yahweh. So what this meant was that the presence of Yahweh in the form of His glory would no longer dwell among His people until it resides anew in a temple to be built by one greater than Solomon, that is, the greater son of David. So we've got a long period from the time of the departing glory from Solomon's temple until the glory resides anew in the temple in the age to come. So keep those things in mind. We're coming back to that eventually. Then, as was prophesied by Ezekiel in his fifth chapter, one-third of the people would perish in the battle for Jerusalem. Another third would die during the 18-month siege. And another one-third would die from famine and pestilence. That's four-thirds, isn't it? One-third would die in the battle. One-third would die in the siege of famine and pestilence. And then one-third, a final third, would be scattered into the wind. So there were three portions of Judah that perished. Two of those were actually killed and died. The remainder of those living in and about Jerusalem were scattered to the wind. So then, these things having been accomplished, there yet was a significant remnant of Jews being held captive in Babylon. Estimates are anywhere from 50 to 70,000. It could have been more, could have been less. I don't know exactly how many were there, but they were at least 50 to 70,000, we believe. Captive Jews still in Babylon, not included in those that were scattered to the wind or those that died in Jerusalem. So, within about 50 years, these captive Jews would rejoice at the decree of Cyrus to restore and to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. Cyrus had been raised up for that very purpose, that is, to build the temple. Isaiah refers to Cyrus in his 44th and 45th chapter as his anointed and as his shepherd. And as such, he was a type of Christ. He portrayed the future events of Jesus Christ, who would be the builder of the temple in the age to come. This decree was made about 536 B.C., and within that same year, Cyrus had provided sufficient funds and material to commence the building of the second temple. Construction began, but it was halted due to the adversaries of Judah for about 15 years until another decree was issued by Darius in 520 B.C., and that reaffirmed that second decree, which was this one over on this side. This was the second decree that confirmed the original decree of Cyrus over here to restore and to build Jerusalem. So construction began again, and within 5 years it was finished, and it was dedicated on March 12, 515 B.C. This is from Ezra, the third chapter, verses 10 and 11, where they were celebrating the laying of the foundation stone of the second temple, not Herod's temple, but the second temple. And this happened approximately 535 B.C., 70 years thereabouts from 605 B.C., about 70 years. So the time periods then coincide nicely. This is a representation of Zerubbabel's temple that was built on dedicated on March 12, 515 B.C., and that also was approximately 70 years from the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. This temple that Ezra and Zerubbabel were involved in looks pretty plain in this picture, but we don't have any descriptions of what this temple looked like. There's only one description, and it says that the facade was 60 to 60. Other than that, we're left to our own imaginations as to what it may have looked like. I would guess that this particular temple probably was significantly more ornate than what we see here, because construction, after this was finished and dedicated in 515 B.C., construction actually continued in and around this building for another 40 years. For another 40 years, they continued to do things and made the temple look considerably better than probably what is depicted here. But on the other hand, we don't have any information as to what it actually looked like, other than what Cyrus said. This is a cutaway of that second temple. So then we can see that there was a facade on the front. It was a lineal building that went backwards, wherein was the holy and the most holy places. And that particular picture there, you notice that it's got the architect's name on it, that Rittmeyer. Brother Herb loaned me a book to read, and anyway, this guy Rittmeyer is probably the most accomplished authority on Herod's temple, and he has a ton of information, and Brother Herb loaned me a book, pretty good sized book. I don't have time to read it this week, but I'll look at pictures. So anyway, if you're interested in that, this Rittmeyer archaeological information here, if you're interested in that, he's the guy to look to. He's the foremost authority. In Ezra, the 6th chapter and verse 3, this is the only details of his construction that we have. It says, in the first year of Cyrus the king, the same Cyrus the king made a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem. Let the house be builded, the place where they offered sacrifices, and let the foundations thereof be strongly laid. The height thereof was 70 cubits, and the breadth thereof was 70 cubits. So what being described here just looks like the face of a building or the facade of a building. And most likely there was a lineal building behind it that contained the holy and the most holy places, as we see in that picture, because the 60 by 60 would not begin to describe what the temple actually was. So that's the information that we have concerning its construction. And as one might imagine, there were mixed emotions among the Jews about this second temple, because upon its completion, we see here in the 3rd chapter of Ezra, it says, but many of the priests and Levites and the chiefs of the fathers, who were ancient men that had seen the first house, that is Solomon's temple, when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, they wept with a loud voice. In other words, they had seen the glory and the spectacle of Solomon's temple, and they lived long enough to see this second temple, and they wept because it was nothing in comparison. They wept, and then there were many others who had not seen the first house, and they shouted for joy. So there was mixed emotions about the whole thing, so that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the noise was heard afar off. And Haggai, the 2nd chapter, verse 3 says, who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory, Solomon's temple? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing? So when we look at Zerubbabel's temple and how it looked and how it compared to Solomon's temple, there wasn't much comparison to it, except we just don't know what the second temple actually looked like. But nonetheless, it was not nearly as much of a spectacle as was Solomon's temple. In Haggai, the 2nd chapter, we should also point out that although the Shekinah glory was not present in Zerubbabel's temple, the work was nonetheless, it was blessed by God. And here in Haggai 2, we read about that. He says, yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord, and be strong, O Joshua, son of Josedech, the high priest, and be strong, all ye people of the land, saith the Lord, and work, for I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts. According to the word that I covenanted with you when ye came out of Egypt, so my spirit remaineth among ye. Fear ye not. So the spirit of God and his direction was still among the people, yet his Shekinah glory did not dwell in this temple. It did not dwell in Solomon's temple. It did not dwell in Herod's temple. So then this temple, Zerubbabel's temple, then would be seen as something of a rallying point for a nation who had now learned a great lesson. Israel had done what? Judah had done what? They had completely forsaken idolatry. They had learned a great lesson. It was a hard lesson for them to be learned, but it was a necessary lesson. And from the time of the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC, the Jews abandon idolatry. Now concerning the furnishings of this temple, these were recovered and brought to Jerusalem to be used in the second temple. Some of them, that is. So beside the various utensils concerning the trimming of the lamp and the table of showbread with the pitcher and the cups, the furniture that was brought back and used in the second temple was one golden lampstand, one table of showbread, and the altar of incense. One table of showbread, the altar of incense, and one lampstand. You recall from Solomon's temple there was the Ark of the Covenant. There were 10 lampstands, there were 10 tables of showbread, and an altar of incense. But the only thing that they had that was left of all that was one lampstand, one table of showbread, and the altar of incense. So, what about the Ark of the Covenant? Some say the Jews hid it in a cave under the Temple Mount before the Babylonians actually came. Others say that the Babylonians carried it away, probably was melted down. But one way or the other, the fact is that the Ark of the Covenant was gone. And if anybody knows where it is, you'll become rich and famous immediately. So what then was in the most holy place in this second temple and that of Herod's temple? According to the Hebrew Mishnah and Josephus, the most holy place was empty. Some historians say there was a small stone that was raised above the floor about 4 fingers high, and upon that particular stone on the Day of Atonement, when the high priest went into this holy place, this most holy place, he would take his censer that he had filled with coals from off the altar of incense, and he would bring it and he had set it on that stone that was in the holy place. Other than that, there was nothing in there. It was completely empty. This is from the works of Josephus in his section against Appian, chapter 2, in verse 8. It says, "Lastly, it is not so much as lawful to carry any vessel into the holy house, nor is there anything therein, but the altar of incense, the table of showbread, the censer, and the candlestick, which are all written in the law, for there is nothing further there." In spite of that, worship continued in the second temple, mostly undisturbed, for 347 years, that is, from 515 B.C. to 168 B.C. And it was at that time that Antiochus Epiphanes, returning from Egypt and having been threatened by Rome to leave Egypt or consider himself in a state of war with Rome, Antiochus was furious at this. He had been rebuffed by the Romans, and he was a man who was filled with pride, and he was furious when he left Egypt. And on the way back, Jerusalem just happened to be in the way. And when he arrived at Jerusalem, he played havoc with everything in Jerusalem. He killed 50,000 Jews. He completely defiled the temple. He drove away all the Judaistic Jews, and he only allowed Hellenistic Jews to remain in Jerusalem. Hellenistic Jews, the difference between a Hellenistic Jew and a Judaizing Jew, is a Hellenistic Jew would worship Greek gods. They accepted whatever worship came along. They were Jews, but they were willing to worship practically any god. And Antiochus left all those there because he knew whatever he did in the temple would be okay and that they would follow his commands. Antiochus robbed the temple of its furnishings. He took everything that was in there. He offered swine's flesh on the altar, and he erected a statue of Zeus, the Greek god of the Olympiad, and he put it in the temple, inside the temple, and he forbade upon the pain of death any to worship after the custom of Judaism. And this particular state of affairs lasted for just a little over 3 years. These atrocities brought about the Maccabean Revolt. Judah, the hammer, could not tolerate the things that had been done in Jerusalem, and he made war with anyone who would defile the temple. The Maccabean or the Hasmonean dynasty lasted approximately 100 years until 63 B.C., And it was then superseded by Roman authority, which brings us to Herod's temple. So we've got a little bit of history about how we got to the point of Herod's temple. So, but when we look in the scripture doesn't say anything about this Herod's temple as it pertains to the man Herod. It doesn't say anything about how it was constructed or anything about Herod concerning the temple. But Christ had plenty to say about it, and that's where we'll get directly. Now, if we're to learn anything about the construction details of Herod's temple, you have to go outside the scripture and rely largely on the writings of Josephus. I believe it's in his sixth chapter. There are, in his sixth book, in about the tenth chapter, I believe, he gives a considerable amount of information concerning this new temple. He said the temple proper was reconstructed by Herod. It was of the same dimensions as that of Solomon, that is 60 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, 30 cubits high, and this space was divided into the Holy of Holies and the Hekel, that is the holy place. The former measured 20 by 20 cubits, the latter 20 by 40 cubits. Now we need to make the point that the second temple, Zerubbabel's temple, was no part of Herod's temple. Then it was torn down, and it was replaced by Herod's temple. So we have three temples. Now there is an idea that Herod's temple was actually saved, and it was enlarged upon and built around and all that. But most of the authorities on this particular subject, and I don't know who I'm calling authority, but most of the writers say that it was completely dismantled, it was taken down to the ground, and Herod's temple was built from thereof. So we have three temples, Solomon's temple, Zerubbabel's temple, and Herod's temple. For those that are interesting in reading about this, you can go to the 15th chapter of Josephus and you can read all about the construction of this temple. As we saw with Zerubbabel's temple, its basic shape was like a T. And this is another quotation from Josephus. It says, the Holy of Holies was quite empty. And in the holy place, it stood the altar of incense near the entrance to the Holy of Holies. There was a seven-branch golden candlestick or lampstand to the south, and the table of showbread to the north. Above the gate of the temple were golden vines and grape clusters as large as a man. And in this particular diagram, you'll note that the basic shape of Herod's temple here was much like that of Zerubbabel's temple. It was a lineal building with a facade on the front. And as you look at that particular drawing there, you see in the upper right-hand corner, it kind of gives you an idea about how large this building was. It looks to me to be about the size of three American football fields. So it was a very large structure. Construction began on Herod's temple in the 18th year of Herod's reign, or about 19 B.C., and it took a year and a half to complete just the temple section. And the interesting thing about this was that the Jews feared that if we let Herod build this temple, he's going to bring in a bunch of Gentiles in here, and they're going to defile the whole place. And they protested to Herod, and Herod agreed and said, yeah, you're probably right about that. So what he did, he took 1,000 priests, and he trained them as masons and carpenters, and they built the temple so as not to defile the temple of Yahweh that they considered would be the temple of Yahweh. So they made an arrangement. The priest built the thing, and it was built according to the size of the dimensions that we looked at a minute ago, 60 cubits by 20 cubits by 30 cubits. The remainder of the temple complex was under construction for the next 81 years, and it was completed in 63 A.D. It took a year and a half to build the temple part of it, but the remainder of the complex was under construction for 81 years. And it was finished just in time to be destroyed. And we'll get to that eventually. What Solomon's, or Herod's temple, rather, may actually have looked like, probably something of that nature, more than likely something of that nature, because there is a significant amount of information from Josephus and various other writers that all agree that this probably is what the temple looked like. It is not listed as one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, but it was in fact considered a wonder of the world, probably someplace between 20 and 30, but it was in fact a wonder of the world. And this entire complex, not just the part you see here in the middle, but the entirety of that complex there measured 144,000 square meters. If that's coincidence or design, I don't know. I'll let you guess at that one. 144,000 square meters. In John the 20th, the second chapter, verse 20, this will confirm our dates, I believe. Then said the Jews, John 2:20, then said the Jews, 46 years was this temple in building, and thou wilt rear it up in 3 days. Of course, Jesus speaking to the priest, he had reference to his body. He was talking about, you will tear down this temple, or this temple will be torn down, but I will raise it up in 3 days. He was talking about himself. He was talking about his own body. So, but what the Jews were talking about was the literal temple. And they said in John 2:20, he said, 46 years this temple has been in building. The construction started in 19 B.C. It continued for 46 years, which brings us to 27 A.D., which that was the beginning of Christ's ministry in 27 A.D. John 2 describes the beginning of John's Christ's ministry. So we're confirmed in our dates with regards to the time of Herod's temple. Now let's see what information the scripture reveals about this temple, and especially what connection Christ had to do with it. Jesus made his first visit to the temple in Jerusalem when he was 40 days old. According to the Mosaic law of childbirth in Leviticus 12, a mother who was bearing a male child would be unclean for 7 days. He would be circumcised on the 8th day, and the 8th day began the count of a 33-day purification process. So Jesus was 7 days old and 33 days old when they went to Jerusalem. He was 40 days old. Luke 2, verse 22 says, and when the days of Herod, that is Mary's purification, according to the law of Moses, were accomplished, they brought him, Jesus, to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. So we're told here that Mary did that which was commanded by the law. And also in this chapter, we see that Simeon recognized and proclaimed that he had seen the salvation of the Lord in the face of this child. Luke 2. And he, Simeon, came by the Spirit into the temple. And when the parents brought the child Jesus to do for him after the custom of the law, then took he him up in his arms, and he blessed him, and said, Lord, now lettest thy servant depart in peace, according to thy word, for mine eyes have seen thy salvation, which thou hast prepared before the face of all people, a light to lighten the Gentiles, and the glory of thy people Israel. And Joseph and his mother marveled at those things which were spoken of him. Thereafter, Jesus and his parents came yearly to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. And on his 12th visit to the temple, he astonished the doctors with his understanding, and he there proclaimed God as his Father. Luke 2. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year to the feast of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. And it came to pass that after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the doctors, both hearing them and asking them questions. And all that heard him, they were astonished. The word astonished means what? Amazed. They were stupefied by what they were hearing from this child. And all that heard him were astonished at his understanding and answered. And he said unto them, when Joseph and Mary came to inquire of his whereabouts, Christ said, wished ye not that I must be about my Father's business? And he wasn't speaking about Joseph. In the second chapter of John, we find Jesus in the temple among the merchandisers who were there selling sacrificial animals for profit. And it says, and the Jews' Passover was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem and found in the temple those that sold oxen and sheep and doves and the changers of money sitting. And when he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them out of the temple and the sheep and the oxen and poured out all the changers' money and overthrew the tables and said unto them that sold doves, the Shekinah glory was not in that temple. But here's what Christ had to say about that temple. He said, take these things hence, make not my Father's house a house of merchandise. The Spirit of Yahweh was among the people, as it had always been. And his disciples remembered that it was written, the zeal of thine house hath eaten me up. Although the Shekinah glory did not reside in either Zerubbabel's nor Herod's temple, it nonetheless was the focal point of Jewish worship, so much so that Jesus said to the money changers, you've made my house a den of thieves. In Matthew, the 21st chapter, verse 21, anyway, that's a picture of what that may have looked like. Matthew 21:14 and Mark 19:9 each tell us that Jesus spent a lot of time in the temple. So his work obviously was centered in and around the temple. And let's go back to that picture. This arrow right here is pointing to this building here over on this side, and that is what they call the Royal Stoa, or the portico, and it was in this particular portion of this complex was where the money changers and those that sold sacrificial animals, they were in this building. They were not in this building. So this is the Royal Stoa, or the portico. And if you'll back up and look at that picture right there, it's kind of hard to tell, but this right here, is a representation of Herod's temple there. This is an open portico. This is the Royal Stoa right here that's being depicted there. Matthew 21:14, and the blind and the lame came to him in the temple, and he healed them. Mark 14, chapter verse 49, I was daily with you in the temple teaching, and you took me not, but the scriptures must be fulfilled. In addition to Jesus, Peter and John also worked in and about the temple. In Acts, the 3rd chapter, verses 1 through 4, now Peter and John went up together into the temple at the hour of prayer, being the 9th hour. And a certain man, lame from his mother's womb, was carried, whom they laid daily at the gate of the temple, which is called Beautiful. And they asked alms of them that entered into the temple. When we look at Solomon's temple, you'll notice I have an arrow drawn to this gate right here that was an entrance into the temple area. It is the Nicanor, or likely the Beautiful Gate. There is some discrepancy there as to exactly where the Beautiful Gate was, but this gate in the foreground was the East Gate. Some say the Beautiful Gate was right here where Peter and John actually healed, but this particular gate right here, which was the Nicanor, and Nicanor means victory. It was the Victory Gate. And some people say this is it, and as you look at it, you can see it's considerably more ornate than this East Gate right here. So we suggest to you that there's a possibility that that was the Beautiful Gate where Peter and John were healing. Concerning Jesus and the temple, probably the most profound and deep-seated things that he had to say about the temple of Herod is found in the 24th chapter of Matthew, when he was with his disciples on the Mount of Olives, and Brother Mac is going to fill us in with regards to the Olivet prophecy and all those things. But in Matthew 24, verses 1 and 2, it says, and Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, see ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. There shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And some people say today, well, there's still stones at the Wailing Wall on the west end of the Temple Mount, but that wasn't part of the temple. That's part of the complex. The temple itself was completely destroyed. The temple, Herod's temple, was leveled. The only stones remaining were part of the outer wall, the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, where you see people gathered today and they do their alms and their prayers and they worship on the Western Wall. That was not part of the temple. That was part of the retaining wall. Jesus then began in Matthew 24, he began a discourse concerning prophetic events that would find their primary fulfillment within 40 years of the time he spoke those very words to his disciples. And this must have been a very difficult thing for Jesus to address, as he knew exactly what part that he was to play in the whole of these things. And he understood Daniel's Messiah the Prince had direct reference to himself. He understood that Daniel 9 spoke directly of him. Jesus realized, and he had already told his disciples, that he must go up to Jerusalem and be killed and be raised again the third day. And that because the Jews rejected him and were to be responsible for his death, the prophecy that he spoke would mean not only the end of the Jewish commonwealth, but also the death of many Jews. Now, when we think about the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, we should think more than just the destruction of Herod's temple. This was a major, major event in the history of the Jews. And here again, we would refer you to the works of Josephus. Josephus was a man who was not only contemporary with the building and the construction of parts of Herod's temple, but he was also involved in Jewish wars. So he was a man that was there. He knew what was going on. In the Wars of the Jews, Book 6, there are 10 chapters therein that describe the devastation of Jerusalem. Josephus records that 1.1 million Jews perished and that 97,000 more were sent into slavery, and they most likely died in the salt mines. It was an end of a way of life for the Jews, as they never recovered. And although the death of Christ 40 years earlier marked the end of the Mosaic era, the events of AD 70 finalized it. Jesus spoke of the destruction, the coming destruction, as based on the prophecy in Daniel 9 and Matthew 24:15, is a direct reference to Daniel 9, chapter verses 26 and 27. On the Mount of Olives, Jesus said, or it says, as they sat down upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when shall these things be? What shall be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world?" And Christ says, "When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place. Whoso readeth, let him understand. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with the flood. And unto the end of the war, desolations are determined." In this same chart, in this graphic on the bottom left there, we see that this was the commencement of Daniel's prophecy of the 70 weeks in 457 B.C. And give us a little latitude on our dates there, because it could be one way or the other some. But I personally happen to believe that the prophecy of the 70 weeks began 457 B.C. and it terminated in 33 A.D. Brother Mac probably will have something to say about that as well. So the prophecy of the 70 weeks is a prophecy that not only predicted the cutting off of Messiah, but it extends itself to the destruction of Jerusalem, as we saw in the references from Daniel. The people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city. He shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. And in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. For the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. In this particular graphic, We see the prophecy of the 70 weeks dissected there, and you'll notice that AD 70 is not part of the 490 weeks. The prophecy does not indicate that the desolation would occur within the 70 weeks, but it occurred later as a result of the actions of the Jews against Messiah during the 70 weeks. Nonetheless, Daniel 9 speaks of the desolation of Israel in AD 70. And this is closely connected to the parable of the marriage feast in Matthew, the 22nd chapter, verses 1 through 7. And if you will, let's go over to Matthew chapter 22. In Matthew chapter 22, verses 1 through 7, we read, "And Jesus answered and spake unto them again by parables, and said, The kingdom of heaven is like unto a certain king which made a marriage for his son. And he sent forth his son to call them that were bidden to the wedding, and they would not come. Again he sent forth other servants, saying, Tell them which are bidden, Behold, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and my fatlings are killed, and all things are ready. Come to the marriage. And they made light of it. They went their way, one to his farm, another to his merchandise. And the remnant took his servants, and they entreated him spitefully, and they slew them. But when the king heard thereof, he was wroth, and he sent forth his armies and destroyed those murderers and burned up their city." And that, of course, speaks of AD 70. In this parable, we see that the king is Yahweh, the son is Jesus, the servants are the apostles, and that the armies of the king are the Roman legions. They are the same as the prince of the people in Daniel 9. The murderers, of course, are the Jews, and the city is Jerusalem. So, in this parable, like we say, the king is God, the son is Jesus. The servants are the apostles, his armies are the Roman army. From Daniel 9, and the murderers were the Jews, and the city, of course, is Jerusalem. So Christ's parable of the marriage feast, his Olivet prophecy, the prophecy of Daniel, the 9th chapter, all converge in a massive calamity that would spell the end of the Jewish commonwealth. The Jewish world had come to an end, or would come to an end, in AD 70. Sacrifice and offering would cease. The temple no longer existed. More than 1 million Jews were dead. The destruction was called the worst catastrophe the Jews had ever been involved in up to that point, and that would continue to be the case for the next 1,866 years until the rise of the Third Reich, wherein 6 million Jews perished. This great victory by the Romans was commemorated in this Arch of Titus, and this particular arch is in Rome. It was built 11 years after the destruction of Jerusalem, and it was built in commemoration of the destruction of Jerusalem, and it's dedicated to Titus. And on the inside of the Arch of Titus, there's a relief here, or a carving, that shows the Romans carrying away the booty from the temple, and that, of course, is the lampstand that they're carrying out. So the whole thing was dedicated to Titus and the victory over the Romans in 70 AD. But was that the end of the matter? Before the destruction of the temple in the first century AD, Yahweh was already at work laying the foundation of his spiritual temple, as seen in Daniel 9, where the prophet, speaking of Messiah the Prince, said, "He shall confirm the covenant with many. His covenant, therefore, being ratified and confirmed by the blood of Christ, the foundation stone thereof was laid." And Paul says in Ephesians, the 2nd chapter, verses 19 to 22, speaking of the beginning of a new temple, he says, "Now therefore, ye are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God, and are built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building fitly framed together groweth into an holy temple in the Lord, in whom ye also are builded together for an habitation of God through the Spirit." The construction of this particular temple will continue until the eighth day, when the New Jerusalem will finally be complete. As with many prophecies, there are both immediate and long-term applications. The Olivet prophecy, we think, is no different. Jeremiah 25, verses 27 to 23 predicts that the cup of trouble given to Jerusalem to drink would be passed to the Gentiles, and they too would be made to drink thereof. The prophet Zechariah, who also was involved in the building of Zerubbabel's temple, prophesies of the commencement of a new age which will clear the now existing Jerusalem in preparation for a new temple. And he speaks of the same time as the prophet Jeremiah, a time when the Gentiles would drink the cup of Yahweh. Zechariah chapter 14. Let's read that, please. Zechariah 14, beginning at verse 1. Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken. The houses rifled, the women ravished. Half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations, as when he fought in the day of battle. His feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west, and there shall be a great valley. The half of the mountain shall remove toward the north, and the half shall move towards the south. And ye shall flee to the valley of the mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach into Azel. Yea, ye shall flee like as ye fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. And the Lord my God shall come, and all the saints with thee. And it shall come to pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark, but it shall be one day which shall be known to the Lord, not day nor night, but it shall come to pass that at eventime it shall be light. And it shall be in that day that living waters shall go forth out of Jerusalem, half of them towards the former sea, half of them towards the hinder sea, in the summer and in the winter shall it be. And the Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day shall there be one Lord, and his name one. And the land shall be turned as a plain unto Geba and to Ramon, south of Jerusalem, and it shall be lifted up and inhabited in her place, and from Benjamin's gate even to the place of the first gate, unto the corner gate, and from the tower of Hananeel unto the king's wine presses. And men shall dwell in it, and there shall be no more utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited. So here then, the prophet Zechariah speaks of a latter day destruction of Jerusalem, and also a latter day return of the Shekinah glory as manifest in Christ and his immortalized saints, which is also described in Revelation as that holy city, New Jerusalem. So then, as the Shekinah glory departed Solomon's temple and ascended from the Mount of Olives in Ezekiel's day, just prior to the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 B.C., the Shekinah glory manifest in Christ also departed from the Mount of Olives prior to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. Zechariah informs us that this Shekinah glory will set his feet again on the Mount of Olives in the latter days, and it will be he who will build the final literal temple in Jerusalem. And that temple will be the subject matter of our Sunday school class in September.